You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hello and welcome to Unceded Airwaves. Hello and welcome to Unceded Airwaves. You are listening to CITR Radio 101.9 FM. Happy Monday morning to you all. My name is Celia Joseph. I'm from Squamish and Nanaimo Nations on my father's side and Jewish and British on my mom's. I'm in my final year of the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program here at UBC, and I am the Indigenous Collective Coordinator for this show.
Hi, I'm going to be co-hosting with Celia today. My name's Samantha Nock. I graduated from FNSP a year and a half ago. I'm Métis from Dawson Creek. My family comes from all across our Sikidawak in our language.
Great. So in this episode, we are going to play for you a radio documentary made by our friend Matt Norris from Lac La Ronge First Nations, who is a master's student here at UBC in Poli-Sci and currently works for the Union of BC Indian Chiefs. So Matt's documentary is part of a series called Resonating Reconciliation, which funded over 40 Canadian community radio stations to produce 30-minute documentaries on the legacies of the Indian residential school system. This project was initiated by the National Campus Radio Association and the Red Jam Slam Society, which we talked to you about a few episodes ago when we interviewed Gunarji O'Sullivan. So please stay tuned for this episode, and then afterwards, Sam and I are going to talk a little bit about what reconciliation means to us, as this topic and these conversations didn't stop during Vancouver's Year of Reconciliation. It's very much still a part of our lives. Indian residential school legacies are very much a part of our lives. And this conversation is still going and thriving. So I'm glad that we can replay this interview for you. And then Sam and I are also going to talk to you about some current events, what's happening in Indian country, what to expect in the city, and then what's happening on a national level.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
All right.
Can you tell us in Indian first, then?
Tansi, Matthew Norris, Nita Nitiga Shun. Hello everyone, my name is Matthew Norris and I'm from the Lac La Ronge First Nations in Saskatchewan. I'm 23 years old, Cree and Canadian. I grew up just outside of Vancouver and I'm currently a master's student in the Political Science Department at the University of British Columbia. Before we begin, I would first like to thank the Musqueam Nation for allowing me to work and live on their traditional and unceded territory. Let me introduce you to a small radio documentary I've been working on for some time. The purpose of this documentary was to answer a seemingly simple question, one that has been asked of me as an Indigenous person and my Indigenous friends more times than we can count. Why are the Indians so angry? Or put nicely, why can't we just let the past be the past? In the context of this documentary, I wanted to frame this question around the legacy of Indian residential schools, the Canadian state's attempt to reconcile for this attempted genocidal act, and how the state's form of financial reconciliation is neither appropriate nor adequate. For as it has been pointed out to me, the Canadian state has apologized. The victims are receiving compensation. What more could we possibly want? For those of you who have asked these questions, or perhaps have been too polite to, this documentary was created with you in mind. For my Indigenous brothers and sisters, these stories are not new. They are too real, too familiar. We know the ins and outs. Many of our family or friends have lived it or continue to. And it is for these reasons why I have chosen not to share the horrific stories of just what occurred in many of the residential schools. If you are unaware of these horrors, then I strongly encourage you to visit the Indigenous Foundation's website, as a wealth of literature has been written about them, condemning the churches and governments of Canada to committing genocidal acts on the Indigenous people who live here. To begin, let me introduce you to Dr. Daniel Justice, citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma and chair of the First Nations Studies Program at the University of British Columbia. I have asked Dr. Justice to explain to us the reasoning behind the existence of Indian residential schools in Canada.
Well, there are a lot of reasons. One of the main ones was for Canadians to be able to absolve themselves of guilt and responsibility for the devastation that colonialism brought to Indigenous communities. And if you could make Indigenous people Canadian, or a servile class of Canadians, then you could step away from the material realities of that process. That would be one. I think another reason was because I think people saw themselves and their cultural experience, mainstream Canadians saw themselves and their cultural experience as the standard to which all people should aspire. And as a way of charity, presumed charity, they brought an education system that some believed would bring Indigenous people to a Canadian standard of civilization. I think some people really thought that they were doing a good thing, and I think some people knew that what they were doing was a horrific thing, but felt it was necessary. Whether it was necessary for Aboriginal people was probably inconsequential to their mind, but they saw that it was necessary, at least for Canada. But I think that the motivations are so diverse, but they all are rooted in some sense of cultural superiority.
Keeping this in mind, I then asked Dr. Justice, how does the Canadian state and Canadian society change someone, not just someone, but a whole group of diverse, proud nations who have no interest in becoming someone else? How do you convince someone to abandon their foundational cultural beliefs, practices, and languages in favor of another?
You strip away their cultural difference. You strip away their language. You strip away their spiritual practice and ceremony. You strip away their family structures, their embodied expression, also gender. You strip away sometimes their gestures, and then you replace those things with the familiar. And then you step away from that and presume that you've created something. It's kind of a Frankenstein process. You take away everything that makes someone human and then try to impose something that you believe is human, but it is imposed through violence, either through violence implied or violence realized. And then you presume that you have created someone in your image. But, I mean, it's playing God, right? Yeah. It's an attempt at playing God, and it never works because it is presented as though it is a benevolent act, but it is always rooted in violence and oppression. And so education becomes weaponized. There's your problem.
So then how does a school system accomplish just such a purpose? What were some of the means that the Indian residential school system used to achieve these goals?
It's harder for a school to accomplish that when people can go home. But if the school is everything that a student is forced to experience. So residential schools were residents, right? Mm-hmm. That's where students went. They had to leave community. And that there's a long history of colonial authorities bemoaning the fact that their school, their education, their assimilation education system isn't working because kids get to go home. Mm-hmm. And they're there with the influences of their friends and family and don't tend to give up who they are too easily. But if you take vulnerable children away from friends and family, away from culture, away from their lands, away from everything that's familiar to them, away from their language, then education becomes a pervasive, all-encompassing force. And even those who are able to resist it are still traumatized by it. And even those who get something out of it are still dealing with profound upheavals. Not everyone who went through residential school felt it was a complete devastation to who they were, but a majority did. And even those who didn't, from my experience that people I've spoken to and people whose testimonies I've read, they acknowledge the fact that it was hard. And hard in ways that went beyond just going to school.
I then asked Dr. Justice if he could help answer the question as to why this is important today.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's not just a thing of the past. It's actually in the living memory of thousands and thousands of people. It's in the living experience, the lived experience of thousands of people. That's not something that is historically distant. And even if we located it in the far distance, the degree of trauma that participants experienced, that most participants experienced, doesn't end when the schools shut down. I mean, if you're intentionally focusing on destroying Indigenous people's families and identities, that has echoes and reverberations all the way through to their children, to their grandchildren. In so many ways in which people experience the world. And again, we have to be careful that we don't presume that everybody who went through... We want to be careful about victim terminology, because people went through horrors, but are still strong people. Oftentimes, I mean, the very fact that they made it meant they were strong, but some people who were strong didn't make it. That it's also about how people exercised whatever agency they could, and some exercised it in really healthy ways and some didn't. But that the effects don't stop just because the schools closed down. Because they went all the way to the soul. These weren't just about giving people a book and making them learn a different language. These schools were about radically reshaping who they were existentially. And you don't walk away from that easily. And Canada certainly can't walk away from that, because many of the issues of trust, of relationship, of righteous grievance that Indigenous peoples have today, they're not all rooted in the residential school system, but the residential school system is probably the most obvious example of just how corrupt and corrosive that system and experience was.
I would now like to introduce Rick Ouellette, the Aboriginal student and community officer at the First Nations House of Learning at UBC. Rick will explain to us how the mentality behind Indian residential schools, as outlined by Dr. Justice, has permeated throughout Canadian society and into the minds of the average Canadian today.
But I think there was something behind that, especially with people who had encountered Aboriginal people. And there's a sort of great tradition of very persuasive orators. And I think people who worked with and dealt with Aboriginal people realized that, in fact, what they were saying was not true. And so it was a matter of convincing them, convincing the non-Aboriginal population that that was in fact true. And residential schools served the purpose of convincing Aboriginal children that they were inferior and their systems were inferior. So at the same time you're telling that to your Aboriginal children, you're also telling that to the non-Aboriginal people and children in their schools. And that's what's so, I think, interesting about the residential school system, was that it was also the public school system was saying the same thing, which is that Aboriginal people are less than us, and that's how we need to think about them. We need to think about them like children who need to evolve to be what we are. But in the residential school system, the Aboriginal children themselves were being told that same message. Mm-hmm. And that's what's interesting about the story, is that people who are non-Aboriginal will also distance themselves and say, well, I had nothing to do with that. But in fact, you did, because you were learning that very story, mm-hmm. right? That Aboriginal people and Aboriginal systems and cultures were less than European cultures.
Let me now introduce Dr. Dori Nason, Anishinaabe professor at UBC in the First Nations Studies Program and the Department of English. She expands on Rick's points, arguing that this way of thinking has stretched into today's school system, negatively impacting Indigenous students throughout Canada.
There might not be religious training anymore, and there might not be that trades training that's very gendered and obsolete, but you still have a narrative that is primary, and sometimes that is, whether it's a Canadian national narrative or an American national narrative, those oftentimes leave out other perspectives, and in particular Aboriginal perspectives. Right. And so if that's not incorporated in a substantial way, then I think you can't, I think it's pretty easy to say that there's still an assimilationist impact, right. Of education that's not thought through to take into account these impacts of history. I'm always, I guess I'm not surprised, but it's always a bit disheartening to hear Native students and non-Native students say to me every year over and over again that this is the first time they've ever heard about X. This is the first time they've ever heard about residential school. This is the first time they've ever heard about the Indian Act. Or, in less negative terms, this is the first time they've read about a remarkable Native woman in the past and the work that she did for her community, that they only either get stories of hardship, or they get stories that paint Native people as not important actors in history. And certainly if you don't see yourself reflected in the material, or if you see yourself reflected in a way that's not positive, then already coming in with intergenerational trauma or low self-esteem about who you are as a human being or where your family's from, I could certainly imagine that that would have a negative impact on whether or not you wanted to take school seriously or to put your time in ways that was expected. On top of that, just knowing that there's a body of knowledge that you might come with from knowing your family's stories or your family's history as being actually not only unacknowledged, but told that it's false. Mm-hmm. So that you might even start to see education as a lie.
I'd now like to introduce my friend, Celia Joseph. Celia is 22 years old, a member of the Squamish Nation, and a student at UBC. Celia will explain to us how the racist mentalities have affected her and her community.
There's like prevalent racism in our system, and part of that is even a lack of education about Northwest Coast people and the relationship that we have and our relationship with a settler. Like colonialism, we didn't even learn about residential schools in high school, you know, and how are you supposed to create understanding between students and create like an understanding of our history here when we're not learning about it, no one's talking about it.
These effects create a huge obstacle for Indigenous people today. But these examples are only some of the many effects residential schools continue to have on our communities. Let me now introduce you to Sean Chapkwe, 27 years old, from Wabagan Lake First Nations, student at UBC and president of the Indigenous Students in Health and Science Association. Sean gives us a powerful account of an additional effect that residential schools have had and continue to have on our communities.
So you have somebody who went through residential school and they were never taught how to love. They were never taught how to parent. They were never taught how to, you know, express themselves, et cetera, et cetera. And now they have all this anger, they have all this anguish, and they leave the residential school, and now they're an adult, you know, their 20s or whatever, and they've never been taught the essential, you know, skills or life, you know, experiences that most people do. And so they have that, they have this this general lack of those things. And then they have children. Well, how are they supposed to teach their children something they never had? You know what I mean? So you know, they teach, you know, they neglect their children, or they don't know how to raise their children. And, you know, a lot of the residential school survivors, understandably, you know, had problems with, you know, alcoholism and drug addiction and stuff like that. So that gets passed on to that generation. So now you have another generation, even though they didn't go to residential school, they still never taught how to parent. They're never taught how to love. They're never taught how to, like, you know, do these things that most people are taught at a young age. And it just kind of gets passed down like that. So the effects of residential school are intergenerational. And the reason I know that is because living on my reserve for 10 years, there was, you know, now that I've had a chance to step back and reflect, I realized that, yeah, there was a lot of problems within our reserve, and it was basically the intergenerational effects of residential schools. You know, people are still having a hard time, you know, figuring out how to parent and figuring out how to raise their children and, you know, and stuff like that, right? So those things are still present today.
Christy Charles, hip-hop and R&B artist from the Musqueam Nation, expands on Sean's observations.
It's like a dark history that people don't share. That's why people don't realize that it's still going on. Like, people are like, oh, get over it, like, that happened how many years ago? Like, the last residential school closed in like 1996 or something like that, and then yeah, we still live under the Indian Act as First Nations people, so it's still here. Like, the residential school effect is still here, and like generational effects, like, I can see it, because when the old people were put into residential school when they were young, they were stripped from their culture, like everybody says, but they were taught coldness, you know what I mean? Like, they lived in an institution that had no love, and it was just dark, and they learned, like, they were always getting in trouble or always doing something wrong and always being punished. So they didn't learn loving and caring because they didn't have family there. So I'm not gonna speak for everyone. Like, I don't wanna, like, put a blanket over it or anything, but I can see it in my family, like, the generational effects of, like, alcoholism within our communities. Like, I see that as a residential school effect, because of people, when they came out of residential school, they didn't know how to cope. Like, they came back to the communities and they had all this culture and love, and they're, like, so confused, and there's that disconnect. And it's like, how do you deal with it? And all this stuff that happened in residential school is absolutely horrible. So from eyewitness, people have drowned their sorrows, right? Drowned their memories of residential school. And that's where the substance abuse and alcoholism came from. I can say from in my family, that's how I see it, but I'm not going to generalize it and say that's how everybody is.
Now, knowing the cause and the effects, clearly the next step is recovery. And in its own way, the Canadian state recognizes this as well. As to the sincerity of the state's effort, I find it questionable. Christy Charles expands on what I mean and expands on the state's approach to reconciliation and recovery.
There's one thing I want to say about residential school and the payments that they get. I think that is absolutely ridiculous. Yes, it's good for some people. Yeah, they get money and it's helping them out. But really, they put them through hell all over again. I just happened to be at my cousin's work one day, and she was the one who was on the other end of the line when elders would call up and be like, hey, I want to apply for my money. Send me the package. And the package, when you open it, you're reading it, and it's a point system that they use for the war. You know, if somebody lost a leg in the war, here's this much money. If you lost two legs, here's this much money. But in the package, it asks you, like, were you sexually molested? Were you raped? Was it oral? Was it touching? And you have to tally up your points, and at the end, however many points you get, that's how much money you receive. And my cousin was on the other end of the line, and it just so happened an elder called when I was there, and she was like, she had to put her on hold, and she started crying. She's like, I don't know what to do anymore. I was like, what do you mean? She goes,
these elders are calling me, and it's like a suicide line. They don't know what to do. They're like reaching out because they're crying and bawling because they had to go through this process, and it just opened all these wounds again. And I'm just like, oh, that's exactly what I mean when I say, like, the government needs to reconcile how they're trying to take care of our people, because they're doing it in the wrong way. They're totally doing it in the wrong way.
Rick Ouellette agrees and expands.
I think that, and I'm sort of repeating what other people have said, but I think a really important part of reconciliation is first to understand what we're reconciling. And we don't know that yet. And so when I'm thinking, and I'll sort of keep it with the topic of Indian residential schools, is that we don't have all the documents yet. We don't know the complete story. So I don't think we can really engage in reconciliation. I think it's a beginning for us to start thinking about it. I think that's how I look at September 18th. But until we have that complete story, how can we reconcile? We don't know what we're reconciling. And you can sort of see that in the news over the last couple of weeks, where 2 weeks ago the story was that, you know, vitamin supplements were used. And now we know there were medical experiments used on children. That came out yesterday. And now there seems to be some evidence that may emerge that the government was actually sort of farming out students to other companies to do medical experiments. And so the story gets really hard after a while. So you can't sort of say, oh, we've reconciled, and then hear that story later. Canadians need to hear and understand the full story, and then what does reconciliation mean? To me, sort of thinking about incarceration rates, life expectancy, all those kind of things, when those things start equaling what it is for the general Canadian population, then I think we're on the right path. But until then, we need to sort of think about what that means. And commit ourselves to understand the story first.
So Rick tells us, we cannot achieve reconciliation with the Canadian state and with Canadian society without knowing the extent of the crimes committed against our children in residential schools. Now, I'm sure many of you are aware of the cries and demands our people and communities have made to the Canadian government for the release of all documents pertaining to the Indian residential school system. Now that some of the documents are finally being released, I would like to bring your attention to the fact that only now the documents are being released. Only now, just as the mandate of the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, is coming to a close, with the time left being too short for a full review. The government took so long to release the huge mass of documents that it is now impossible to give them the attention they require before the mandate runs out. If the Harper government was really sincere about the process, it would not only release the documents fully, it would extend the mandate of the TRC to accommodate its own significant and intentional delays. And this is what I call for, an extension of the TRC's mandate to allow full investigation into all documents pertaining to Indian residential schools. Seeing as long-term, genuine reconciliation is not on the government's immediate agenda, it is up to our communities, our elders, and our youth to recover and lift ourselves up on our own terms. Celia explains how this process has already begun.
Well, we are still around today. There are only 20-odd Squamish speakers left, but we've got initiatives, right? We have people that are learning it. We're teaching it in our elementary schools and in our daycares, you know, and like we're starting to potlatch again, and we're starting to wear regalia again. So there's so much devastation, and there's so much addiction, and so much was lost, but still around, you know. I think they really gave a huge obstacle for a lot of Indigenous communities, and some of that damage is irreparable. But I think right now is a very interesting time, because now we're a couple generations away from being in residential schools ourselves, so like we have a lot of people who are capable of looking at our culture again, are capable of asking questions and turning back, because we're far enough away from these direct effects that people are starting to learn how to be healthy again, you know, and learning how to hold each other up in a way that just couldn't before, you know. And so a lot of that happens through really neat community initiatives working with elders and youth and like working together with language and with music. It was huge with song.
Christy confirms these same processes are occurring throughout the Musqueam Nation as well.
In this time that we're living, our generations, we're bringing it out, right? We're bringing it back. We're waking up the songs and we're waking up the stories. And our people have been taking care of ourselves. And to this day, we still have people doing our sacred work. Like right now, we have a group of six young people going on a canoe journey to represent our nation and share our songs and share our stories with other communities. And that's something that we're doing nation to nation. And the government, when they come into our community and try to work with our community and try to reconcile with our community, they're doing it the way they think is best. Which is, when you look at it, it's kind of coming in and doing the same kind of thing that they did in residential school, right? Okay, we think this is good for you. We think this is going to solve the problem. But really, they need to give us the voice and us the platform to stand up and say, as a people, we are healing, so please, just walk alongside us or something. I know it sounds idealistic, but that's the way it needs to be done.
We've now come to the end of this short documentary on just some of the legacies of Indian residential schools. I hope this has helped to answer some of your questions, and I hope I have managed to show how residential schools have affected and continue to affect our people, that the colonialism, assimilation, and oppression of Indigenous peoples throughout Canada and the U.S. is not a thing of the past, but still exists in extremely powerful and oppressive ways which affect the lives of Indigenous people on a daily basis. I would like to thank those individuals who shared their time and stories with us, and those people who have, but who I was unable to share their stories with you. I would like to once again thank the Musqueam Nation for allowing me to live and work on their traditional and unceded territory. And thank you, the listeners, for supporting projects such as this. I'll now leave you with a song by Christy Charles, or as many know her, Ms. Christy Lee. This is Matthew Norris at 101.9 CITR FM. This documentary is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association and has been made possible through the support of the Red Jam Slam Society and funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada. The National Crisis Line, in case any listeners are triggered by the contents of this documentary, is 1-866-925-4419. The provincial number for British Columbia is 1-877-477-0775.
No way to say on how you make me feel in the grandest of way. These words I have to say ain't like anything you ever heard in your day. Straight spitting my ways, this is how I play. Live my life in the realest way. See how I do me, yes, in what I see. Yo, you're just like me, so happy to be upon the scene. This is what I mean. You live super long and kept yourself strong. Now in these times, I can spit these ill rhymes. Ain't committing no crimes. Yo, you did as good, this is how we could. Straight rap herself. Your knowledge is my wealth, so respect is dealt. And the love is felt, without a doubt. No more screaming, shout, time to let this out. Missy M, Missy I, steps in white summits and steps in I know. Hide the troll and quits me, quits nama. Thunder was still. Now what you gotta see is you and me be living in the times that they was living for. Now it's our turn to give it just a little more. It's our turn to spit what we learn and make a burn upon the spot. Believe it or not, we the future of history. So stop living your life like it were a mystery. You know who you gotta be, yo, just take a look at me. Little Miss Christy Lee, CM family. That's a secret, you gotta keep it down on lock. Show them what you got, we the ones that they was talking about. Without a doubt, time to let this out. Just be yourself.
Hello and welcome back to Unceded Airwaves. We just listened to a radio documentary which was created by the Resonating Reconciliation Project, and that was done by Matthew Norris, who's from Lac La Ronge First Nations and is a master's student in poli-sci at the Union of BC. He is a master's in poli-sci and also currently works for the Union of BC Indian Chiefs. You are listening to CITR Radio 101.9. This is Unceded Airwaves. And the theme of this episode is going to be on reconciliation. I'm sitting here with Samantha Nock. Hi. Please stay tuned. We're going to play a couple songs for you, and then we'll come back and continue our episode. Mm-hmm.
Alex! You blew it up! God! Santa?
Oh! Nothing like the salt air! Now, if you excuse me, I have a concert to attend.
On December 5th, Mint Records will be hosting this year's Ridiculously Early Xmas Party at the Astoria with performances by Rennie Wilson, Monomyth, Fake Tears, Energy Slime, Supermoon, Uptights, and a Faith Healer solo set. CITR Femme Concept DJs will be playing the hits all night long, and yes, there will be presents for the first 50 people. Visit mintrex.com for more details. Remember, it's this December 5th at the Astoria.
Offered through the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program, FNIS 401G, Indigenous Law and the Settler State, is a three-credit course being taught by Nuchaluth scholar Johnny Mack in Term 2. This course will focus on the relationships between Indigenous law, state law, and policy, whilst taking up key issues of their legal agency in the lawmaking process. Please visit fnis.arts.ubc.ca for more information.
All right, hello, welcome back to Unceded Airwaves. I am one of the hosts, Celia Joseph.
And I'm the other host, Samantha Nock.
So if you were tuning in earlier, you were listening to a radio documentary, which was part of a radio show series called Resonating Reconciliation, and it was directed and created by Matthew Norris. And so now Sam and I are here to talk to you a little bit about our thoughts on where we're at now in terms of this whole reconciliation business and what's happening.
Yeah. Where would you like to start?
Wow. Well, it's a little bit of a big undertaking, but we just we wanted to re-air the documentary to kind of keep the conversations alive, and Matt put a lot of work into that documentary, and he interviewed a lot of important people and active thinkers and writers in the community, and it's still relevant, right?
It's still really, really relevant. I mean, just because the TRC came to a close and the document was put out, it doesn't mean reconciliation has stopped or these conversations have stopped, because especially for Indigenous people, especially in our lives, reconciliation is kind of within everything we do. And you even see now, like, I think the new government has, like, an entire cabinet or whatever for reconciliation, like... Very informed. So, like, just because the TRC is finished, reconciliation has still woven itself into our lives. But I think there are bigger conversations we can move on or move forward in the, like, terms of reconciliation.
Yeah, and it's interesting when the word reconciliation becomes synonymous with the TRC, because the idea of reconciliation is has a much longer history in terms of thinking about what healing looks like. Mm-hmm. And I think it was, like, only a few weeks ago, there was that Twitter hashtag that was trending, which was, like, not my reconciliation or reconciliation is this or something. Do you remember what it was?
I don't remember the hashtag, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And anyways, it was a bunch of active people on Twitter tweeting about what their reconciliation actually looked like, because as we enter this new chapter in our government, a lot of the issues are going to stay the same, and healing, though it was started in different ways through the TRC, it surely hasn't ended, right?
Yeah, well, I think if we move beyond and start decontextualizing reconciliation outside of the conversations about residential school, we can begin to see that reconciliation isn't just about healing ourselves from this really horrific past that was so violent and so present in our lives that, you know, I think it's just moving beyond that and looking at what reconciliation actually means in terms of Indigenous state and Indigenous settler relationships. So reconciliation isn't just for Indigenous people. Reconciliation is for everybody that is on Turtle Island. So, I mean, yeah, we need to heal from residential schools, and I think we can do that in our nations, how we need to, in which ceremonies, in which ways work for us. But in terms of reconciliation, really, it's like looking at how us together as people who are from this land and as people who occupy this land, how we can heal from colonization and colonial violence.
Mm-hmm. And then there are like lots of people talk about we can't have reconciliation without restitution.
Yeah.
So like apologies only go so far when things aren't changing.
That's true. And reconciliation, even though it is not just for Indigenous people, it has to happen on Indigenous terms.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, somebody who hurts you, the person who hurts you isn't the person who tells you how you're going to heal from that.
Mm-hmm.
So Indigenous people, the people who were hurt, the people who are surviving colonial violence every day, mm-hmm. are the people who set the conversation for what reconciliation looks like, not in settlers.
Yeah. And so I think it's important for us to air this documentary and continue having these conversations and to think, okay, like Vancouver, however many thousands of you came out for the TRC walk during our year of reconciliation, it's like, well, we need to see those numbers maintain as the year comes through. When it comes to direct action, when it comes to solidarity marches, when it comes to our march on February 14th for murdered and missing Indigenous women, who's going to show up then, right? Mm-hmm. So we need just to be keeping the conversations alive about the commitments that we made to each other during mm-hmm. this year of reconciliation, right? Which was last year. But these conversations cannot stop, and it's such a risk if they do, or if it appears that something has been concluded or a book has been closed, right?
Yeah, and I think it's really exploring these conversations about what allyship looks like and about what reciprocity looks like when you come to reconciliation. So, yeah, you were there for, you know, the witnessing events for the TRC. You were there for the walk that happened last year. I think it was actually like 10,000 people showed up, which is awesome. You're here for these big landmark things, but yeah, like, where are you for like the Women's Memorial March, but also like, where are you when we're celebrating things, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't just show up when we're hurting. You have to be there with us every step of the way.
Mm-hmm. Or show up when it's comfortable, right?
Yeah.
Like remembering something that happened that in people's minds happened and is closed. Mm-hmm. They are not accountable. Engaging in that kind of relationship is much more comfortable, as opposed to thinking about how are these relationships being perpetuated today? What is going on in a contemporary basis, which we are all accountable for mm-hmm. holding each other up through?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is all about just being in that sort of relationship where you're holding each other up, but holding each other accountable,
mm-hmm.
especially if you're non-Indigenous mm-hmm. in this conversation. I think you have to check yourself every step of the way. Or you just have some good aunties that'll check it for you. But
yeah. And so I think on that note, we can just think, just put it out there, and we'll mm-hmm. ask our viewers to think about what reconciliation looks like and what it means to keep these conversations going.
Our listeners.
Our viewers. I'm right. Our listeners.
We're not aunties.
I hope no one's viewing us right now.
I don't know. It's kind of like a fishbowl in here.
My hair doesn't look very good. Okay. Yeah. So to move on to current events. What's happening in the city.
Yeah. So what's happening in the city, Celia?
Okay. So there is a screening of the documentary Highway of Tears and a panel. So the documentary has had some mixed reviews. So we encourage you to go think about your own thoughts and feelings about the documentary. It will be airing November 30th, 6 p.m. in the Norm Theater. And there are panelists Audrey Siegel, Elma Tail Feathers, Summer Rain, and Faye Blainley. And they're going to give their thoughts about the documentary and this very important issue.
The Norm is here at UBC, right?
Yes.
I have a very vivid hit. Yes, the Norm is here at UBC.
Okay. And then also on December 9th, so 2 Wednesdays from now at 7 o'clock at the Western Front, Dory Nason will be giving a lecture on E. Pauline Johnson and Indigenous feminist performance. And so Dory is a professor here at the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program and in the English department. She teaches Indigenous feminisms and Indigenous lit. She is an all-around powerhouse, and both Sam and I adore her, so we encourage you.
Biggest fangirls.
Yeah, totally. We encourage you to go see this talk. I went and saw Dory last year at the Western Front, and it's a relatively small room. It fills up quick because Sam and I are not the only fangirls in the city
Mm-mm.
of that woman.
No,
so
she's great.
She's great.
Yeah.
Great. So, Sam?
All right. So, for our news topic, we are giving a big handshake and applause to Billy Ray Belcourt, who is a Cree student from Driftpal First Nation who became the first Indigenous Rhodes Scholar, which is astounding.
Mm-hmm.
So proud.
Yeah, so huge shout out to him.
Yeah, and we kind of just want to discuss what that means to be an Indigenous Rhodes Scholar. So the history of the Rhodes Scholarship is controversial at best. Cecil Rhodes was a British imperialist South African miner way back and created Rhodesia, which the things are not stacking up for this fella. And he created the scholarship to kind of how does one phrase this?
Oh, I don't know. Right his wrongs.
Not right his wrongs. To
enforce his legacy.
To make it academia a lot whiter.
Yeah.
To keep it white, basically.
Yeah. And unfortunately for you, we now have a queer Cree man who is taking up the name.
Yeah, an article I read said that the Rhodes Scholarship looks a lot more feminine and a lot more brown than he had anticipated, which is great. But yeah, so like, what are you going to say?
Can you talk a bit more about what the Rhodes Scholarship actually is, where you go to school? She's like, no.
Oxford.
Yeah.
Oxford.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, some people might not know that. So also, there's just the implications of going and studying your theory in good old Britain.
Good old Britain, yeah. Just having an queer indigenous person in Oxford studying this amazing decolonial theory, like, just raise my hands up. That's so mm-hmm. awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And just completely taking the Rhodes Scholarship and just being like, you know what? Frick you, Cecil.
Yeah, and that's another thing is that he's been quite public about the implications of this award, and he's been calling into question the legacy of Rhodes himself.
But also wrote this amazing article for Rabble talking about how the media has been portraying him. So talking about how he came from this family of violence, blah, 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 when that wasn't necessarily true. And how people are sensationalizing his history as an Indigenous person and making it violent, making it sad, and focusing on all this, like, horrible stuff that isn't necessarily true 100% to his story. And it's just like, yeah.
Yeah.
Damn.
Well, he's calling into question the type of Native that mm-hmm. that is palatable, right? So
yeah.
It's either got to be this tortured, like, this tortured Indigenous person that comes from this and this mm-hmm. and this, and who is like risen out of the ashes, you know, like he's got to be the exception,
yeah,
right, as opposed to just someone who's worked really hard and really deserves this.
That's very true. Yeah, trying to portray him as the exception to all our stories, trying mm-hmm. to make him the good Indian, you know, so mm-hmm.
who comes from like squalor,
yeah.
right? So
yeah.
He's not like the other Indians. He's an exceptional Indian, yeah. right?
Which he is, but story.
But not in the way that it's yeah. framed.
Not in
right?
the way he's framed.
He's
yeah.
one of many incredibly talented thinkers,
mm-hmm.
and has a skill set and a type mm-hmm. of knowledge that is being valued. And of course, we know that we come from communities of with a plethora of skills
mm-hmm.
and a variety of knowledge holders,
mm-hmm.
and we hold all of that knowledge up, and so we hold our hands up to him, and we're so excited for him, but we know that he's on one front of many, where all of our people are making differences and all of our people are sharing their stories and their knowledge, whereas he's being framed as like an anomaly. Or
that's very true, and I think that's a great way to say it, that yeah, his story is being held up as an anomaly to all our stories. When I'm not saying like getting the scholarship and going to Oxford, that is amazing,
mm-hmm.
like that is fantastic work, but as Celia said, our nations, our communities have a fantastic amount of talent and knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
I think that's what he was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was like, can we not focus on these contrived stories you've mm-hmm. created for me?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to present myself how I want to. I'm going to celebrate this award, but I'm also going to talk about the complexities of it. And I'm really impressed with that because it was an exciting moment of triumph for him.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also feel the emotion in that decision. And we're always being pulled that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the academy, it's really not, it's not so easy to know how to navigate these spaces.
True. And I think he's going to go there, kick ass,
mm-hmm.
and hold everybody accountable.
Represent.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, well, this brings us to the end of the episode. So thank you so much for listening.
Yes, thank you to our listeners. And also thank you to Musqueam, whose mm-hmm. unceded ancestral territories we're broadcasting from.
Yes, Haichka OCM, our hands are up to you, and we can't wait to see you again. Talk to you again
next
Monday. Yeah. Okay. Up next is Synchronicity, so please stay tuned for this wonderful show.
Offered through the First Nations and Indigenous Studies Program, FNIS 401M, Politics, Protocol, and Place in Indigenous Performing Arts, is a three-credit course being taught by Shimshian scholar Michael Dungele in Term 2. I can choose which path This course will engage with a wide array of Indigenous performing arts presented in unceded Coast Salish territories to explore the artistic response to settler colonialism. Please visit fnis.arts.ubc.ca for more information.